I wanted to start out by giving you some idea of this continent of Africa. It may be that some of you are acquainted with the geography, but we have found so often a lot of people have very strange ideas about geography of Africa. First of all, we call this is the second largest continent in the world, very huge. Most of these countries now are independent countries, with the exception of Namibia, which is dependent upon South Africa. But to give you an idea of the of some of the distances here, when we were in Namibia, which is here, I remember getting a letter once from someone up here in the Northwest. She said she had a friend with whom she corresponded in Ghana. And she said, she wrote to us and she said, since you folks are living in the same area, perhaps you'd like to pop in and visit this person. Well, here's Ghana up here. And I wrote back to her very respectfully as I could, and I said, we are as far from Ghana as you are from Nicaragua. And you know, you don't go popping in on people in Nicaragua, you kind of make it long journey out. Okay, so here's Africa. In the previous century, there was what has been called the scramble for Africa, where European countries were scrambling to get colonies in Africa. Germany was a little bit late in this scramble, but round about the year 1880s, Germany did acquire German Southwest Africa, which we now call Namibia, and also, Tanzania over here, and they acquired this little strip here. You see this little strip of Namibia sticking out here? It's the Caprivi Strip, named after a Count Caprivi who followed Otto von Bismarck as the Chancellor of Germany. It was ceded to them by the British, and they wanted it in order to give them access to the Zambezi River, and presumably also across to their colony, German East Africa. The Portuguese first settled here, or first touched on the west coast there of Namibia in about 1484. And so for the next 400 years, you might call that the colonial period. As I said, through the Berlin Conference in the 1880s, the Germans had Namibia as their own possession. Now, in 1915, to give you a little of this history, in 1915 the Germans lost Namibia, right after the First World War, through the Treaty of Versailles in 1918, they lost Namibia, and it was mandated to South Africa. South Africa at that time was part of the British Commonwealth, and South Africa was told to nurture this country to independence. This was the mandate that was given to them by the League of Nations. They held on to Namibia. I have to say that throughout that history, to my knowledge, did nothing whatever to nurture this country to independence, but simply exploited it for all it was worth. In 1966, the United Nations, which we would think of as the successor to the League of Nations, actually gave out an order to South Africa that they must cease and desist from occupying Namibia. Because they said, now it's time for you to leave, and by United Nations Security Council Resolution number 435, which is a magic number in Namibia, all the black citizens of Namibia know exactly what you mean when you say 435, because they pray for it every day that resolution might be implemented. It was made illegal, and since 1966, totally illegal for the South Africans to be occupying Namibia. They paid absolutely no attention to this United Nations to this Security Council resolution. To go back a little bit in this history, during the time of the German colony, Namibia, the German colony, German Southwest Africa, the Germans went through some really nasty times with some of the original tribes there. They engaged in genocide. Round about the turn of the century, well, one of the tribes is the Herero tribe. They numbered at that time 80,000 people. And the German armies there cut them down to 20,000. There were 130,000 Namas and Damaras. They cut them down to about 40,000. And somehow or other, they had the idea that these people were dangerous. Now, the Hereros, for example, that's one of the tribes in Namibia, are a very proud people and very intelligent people. Well, they're all intelligent people, as far as that goes. But the Hereros are particularly an aggressive people. When white people first came, they weren't sure if they should accept them. They were a little bit inferior, the Hereros thought, because they were white, inferior white people. But they said, well, okay, we try to live together and so forth, and they tried to work out agreements and treaties. And finally, the Germans, with their greater firepower, were able to decimate the Herero tribe and the Namas and Damaras as well. So that's one of the things that's in the history of Namibia. Let me say a little bit more about the geography here, though. Namibia, to give you an idea of the size, is as large in territory as California, Washington, and Oregon put together. That's a very large piece of real estate there. And in that piece of territory, there live approximately 1.5 million people. So you can see that it's a very sparsely populated country, one of the most sparsely populated countries in the world, I suppose. 1.5 million people, and in that country, over 90,000 South African troops. It's also one of the most militarized countries in the whole world. What else can I say? It's about 85 to 90% black people living in Namibia, 10% white. The white people are descendants, many of them, of the German, early German settlers, and some new Germans who have come, and also Boers, that is Afrikaners, who have come up from South Africa, since South Africa simply rules the territory as though it were a province of its own. This means that you have three official languages in Namibia, German and English and Afrikaans, which is the Dutch-like language of the South African country. Beside that, you have the tribal languages, because you have the various tribal groups that I've mentioned, some of those, the Herero, the Nama and Damara, closely related, and the largest tribal group in Namibia, living mostly in the northern part called Ovamboland, is the Ovambo people. And also Kavango land is up there, and the Kavango and Ovambo are related. They are also related to the Hereros. They are, I think, what would be called in the larger group of Bantu Africans, as distinguished, for example, from Zulu and so forth. But these are the Bantu Africans. Maybe the Zulus even part, I don't even know. There is actually, as in every country, there is no pure ethnic group anymore, really. You also have the Bushmen in Namibia. They live in Namibia and also in Botswana, and also called the San, S-A-N. And if any of you, I was talking to some of you before about the, if any of you have ever seen this film, The Gods Must Be Crazy, have you? It's a really nice film. It's funny too. And in my opinion, the perfect gentleman, the hero of that particular film is the little Bushman. The Bushmen are, they're an African people. They're not so very dark. Their skin color is almost brown, yellow brown. Small people. They're not pygmies though, but they're small. I think at the most 5 feet is usually their height. Very intelligent people in the ways of the desert and of the veldt. They know how to survive in the most trying conditions. For example, they know how to find water in the midst of the desert. In a country like Namibia is 80% desert. And Botswana, by the way, the neighboring country, also has very much a desert. Sand people know how to survive there. One of the things they do, for example, is in a time of very severe drought, when you have to go pretty deep to get water, in order to find water, they will capture baboons, and they will feed them food that makes them very thirsty, and then they release them, and then they just follow them, and the baboons go to the nearest water. And it's very brilliant the way they do this, and then they know how to get the water. And if you wanted to read a novel that tells something about the way in which the Bushmen, the Sand people, survive and live, it's called The Burning Shore by Wilbur Smith. An interesting novel, and it touches on things in Namibia.
I would just like to interject that the South Africans say of them that they can't tame the Bushmen, because they are still, they might work for them, and at a certain time of the year they just get this feeling that they've got to move on, and then they'll disappear for a couple of months and then they'll come back again. But so that's the way they classify them, that they can't tame them.
Yeah, that's right. The Bushmen are the Nama people in Namibia are probably related to the Bushmen. The languages are related. Their languages are the languages what we call a click language. And I don't know if you've ever heard of that. In the Nama tongue, there are four clicks. And I don't, she was making some of them, and she always claims that she can do them better than I can, so I don't think I'm even going to try. But there are four separate and distinct kind of clicks. And of course,
each click has four different tones.
Has tones to it, too. And it's a very complicated language. It's difficult to learn, very difficult to learn. And you got to be a pretty intelligent person to be able to talk like that. really. But it's only comparatively recently that the language has been put into a written form. So they use different symbols. They use slash symbols and exclamation mark symbols, for example, to indicate in a slash with two marks on it to indicate the different clicks. But it's most interesting to hear a couple of Nama people converse with one another, or to hear, and by the way, the majority of Namibians, vast majority, are Christians, to hear a Nama choir sing a song in church and do all their clicks, the whole choir doing all their clicks at the right time and everything like that.
Especially a Bach chorale.
And it's a Bach chorale. It's a tune that you know. And it's got all in there. Or the Pachelbel Canon. I remember hearing him sing from the Pachelbel Canon, and all the clicks are there. So a very, very interesting, group of people. Let's see, what else can we say about? Oh yeah, another group that I forgot to mention is, you must pardon the expression, but there is a group called the Basters. Now this is spelled B-A-S-T-E-R. And it means almost what you think it means. It refers to colored people. Now you see, in the South African separation system or apartheid system, they distinguish between black and colored. And colored people are part European and part black. Down in the Cape province, down here around Cape Town in South Africa, you have what they call the Cape Colored, and probably the so-called Bastards of Namibia, or colored people, originally came from the Cape Colored down in the south here in Cape Town, and came up here and settled particularly around a town called Rehoboth, and they are called the Rehoboth Bastards, or the Rehoboth Colored. The colored race, or the Bastard race in southern Africa, they say, started 9 months after the first white settlers arrived. And no doubt this is true. The colored or Bastard people have almost all of them have European names. And you can tell by their names. And their names might be French, or because the Huguenots were among early settlers in South Africa, you know, or Dutch names, or possibly German names, and sometimes Scotch-Irish type names. That's also, those names are also found among the Bastards. So there you see the social divisions. We're already making reference to apartheid, and we're going to be referring to that quite frequently during these next days, and part of our discussion in a later day will be specifically on the subject of apartheid, the theological meaning, the social meaning of it, and political meaning of that. But just for now, I make that reference. They have the whites on top, and then the colored, and then the black. In South Africa also, they have a separate place for Indians, well, that is East Indians, people from India. They're about on the level with colored, I think. They're a little above black, according to the South African way of looking at things.
The Japanese are honored whites.
Honorary whites. The Japanese are called honorary whites. You see, they bring a lot of money into South Africa, so they're honorary whites, and they can cross the lines. They can go into the white places. But all over, and when you travel in South Africa, some of you folks have been there, and you know how that is. You have separate entrances for the blankies and the, you know, for the whites and the blacks. Well, let's see. What else can I say about the geography? Or does anyone have a question to spur me on a little bit about what we've been talking about so far? This is introductory to give you an idea of this country.
Why do the South African troops, why do they insist on keeping, what is it, 80,000 troops up there?
A good question. Thank you for that question, because it reminds me of something I wanted to say before. South Africa regards all of Southern Africa as its sphere of influence. Okay, and these states that border on South Africa, if you read the news, you've maybe seen this term, the frontline states. I don't know if that's a familiar term, but the news media uses that term, referring to these states in Southern Africa, which South Africa wishes to regard as under their sphere of influence. That will include, the frontline state would be Angola, Botswana here, Zambia here, Zimbabwe, which was formerly Southern Rhodesia, Zambia was Northern Rhodesia, and Nyasaland, I think, was, and Mozambique over here. Those are the so-called frontline states. And South Africa has a couple of reasons for wanting to keep Namibia occupied with their troops. One is political, because they see these other countries have all now become independent. This is frightening to South Africa, because the only black country left that is not independent is Namibia. They would like to at least preserve that as a buffer between themselves and Angola here, which is also, by the way, Marxist. And for the South African government to say Marxist is a really bad word. Well, they say communist, and it's not really quite the same. The second reason is economic, why they occupy the country. Namibia is a rich country, although it's 80% desert, has many minerals, has uranium and diamonds, tin, copper, silver, and then some of these other exotic minerals that I don't know too much about. I think like lithium and vanadium and some of those kinds of things that I don't know much about. But South Africa exploits the country for all it's worth on those minerals. And it has been said that they're digging diamonds out of there just as fast as they can, because they see the writing on the wall. When that country goes independent, they're going to leave it poverty stricken. And that's apparently what they aim to do. But I have to tell you that the South Africans are not the only ones who are profiting from these minerals. The British, the French, and the United States are also profiting from these minerals. And unfortunately, they are not turning profits back into the country, but taking them out, so that the country is really, the black people in the country are really quite poor. Pretty soon it's going to be Lois's turn, but not yet.
What about their turn?
Well, their turn is always, you see. I mean, you must interrupt any time.
I brought in.
Did you have something more?
No, I just butt in.
Okay. No, any time, of course, you must butt in. It's perfectly fine. Jim?
Maybe you've mentioned this before, but how do the majority of Namibians make their form of living or subsistence?
Okay. Many of them are working in the mines. And in the northern part, which is more fertile, a lot of agriculture goes on there and cattle raising. But all through the country, even in the desert places, you have some cattle and a lot of goats. Goats are pretty hardy animals. Some sheep. So there's a certain amount of farming. The black people work for the white farmers who have large farms. We would really call them ranches. And the mines, mostly it's the Ovambo people from the north who come down and work in the mines as contract laborers. They come without their families. There will be more detail on that coming up in future things. But that's the way they make their living. Now, I should probably tell you, in part of this introduction, what we were doing there and where we were. We were in the middle of this country, in a little African village called Ochimbingwe, where there is a Lutheran seminary. Lutherans comprise more than half of the population of this country. And tomorrow, or whenever our next session is, I'm going to tell more about the history of the missions and so forth. But just for now, Black Lutheran churches have established this seminary where I was teaching New Testament and Greek and homiletics and whatever was left, you know, over. We had 6 ordained people on the staff, and so you take whatever is left. 4 of our staff people were Namibian teachers or professors, lecturers as they call them. 2 of us were white. There was a lecturer from Germany, and there was myself. And then Lois was also teaching English, because our medium was English, since they all came with different tribal tongues. The English language was the common tongue. So that's what we were doing there, and we were there for 3 years upon their invitation, since the church there is indigenous. They sent an invitation to the Lutheran Church in the United States and said, could you send over someone who could teach us, and because now we're using the English language. Okay? Now,
any more questions
on what we are saying so far?
What is the population of Namibia?
It's about 1.5 million, perhaps a little more, because sometimes they don't do very accurate census among the black people. But we usually say 1.5 million.
That doesn't include the people in exile, and there are
there's about 80,000 in exile. A lot of Namibians are in exile in Angola and in Zambia. And even in Europe and other places, because they're chased out by the security police. And I have read 80,000 in exile.
The education system in Namibia, which depending if you're white or black, whether it's good or bad. First, I'll start out talking about preschools. And there are quite a few preschools that are run by the German, that are supported by the Germans and are usually connected with churches
And not necessarily only Lutheran churches, some of the other churches also have preschools. But I think that this is really helpful to give these kids a chance to have a different idea of what education can be. And the German gal and I ran a preschool or play school, whatever, in Ochambingway for the lecturer's children and for the students' children, and then some of the workers at the seminary for their children from the village. But it was kind of interesting to note that even among these little children, the children who came from the village were, well, they just were poorer than the children of the lecturers or the others, or the students even. And those little kids would really pick on those kids from the village. They knew that they just somehow felt that they were a little bit better than the village kids. And that was, I don't know, I just didn't expect that, but I guess it's natural. Anyway, we taught in English again, and none of the children, I think five children could understand and speak a little bit of English, and there were about 25 kids, and the rest of them would talk to us in their click language or their other language, and finally we could understand a few words and know when they had to go to the bathroom or whatever they wanted. And they could finally understand some of the things. I think they understood us more than we understood them. But for most of them, that was their first exposure ever to, say, a manufactured toy of any kind, or to puzzles or crayons or books. And we did puppet shows and that kind of thing. And when we did a puppet show, the seminary students, if it happened to be their break, would also come and stand there fascinated at this puppet show. And we used flannel graph and that kind of thing for telling Bible stories. And we went on hikes by the river where the trees were and avoided the snakes. But anyway, then the main education is the Bantu system. And we did have an elementary school in Ochambingway, maybe of about 800 children. The village itself, I would say, was a population of over 3,000. But some of these children would come from various areas of the country. If they wanted to go to school in their language, and the languages that were being taught in this school was Oshiherero and Nama. And they went to school in these languages, either one, for the first 2 years. And their school system is A, B, and then standard 1, 2, 3, 4. So when you get to standard 6, that's like our equivalent of 8th grade. I lost my train of thought there.
How they studied the language and stuff.
Oh yeah, they went to school for the first 2 years in their own tribal language, and they learned to read and write that. Then in third grade, they had to start studying Afrikaans. And Afrikaans, some of them knew Afrikaans before, but some of them didn't. And from then on, all their education is in Afrikaans. In fourth grade, they have to start to study English. And in fifth grade, they have to start to study German. So they have to learn all these languages. And then in they reach standard 6, that's eighth grade, they have to take a test and be able to have some kind of equivalent of pass to move on to the higher education. And so they learn very little math. They learn very little science. They take math up to just fundamental math, and that's it. After that, the white man's decided that they can't study any further than that. That's all they're capable of learning. Of course, this is the main reason they have school is to produce laborers. If you, from standard 2, that's a literacy equivalent. And then if you make standard 6, you get a better class of a laborer. And then if you make standard 8, which would be 10th grade, that would give you the right to become a teacher, a nurse, or a policeman. And you can become a teacher after finishing, which would be the equivalent of a 10th grade education. You can become a nurse with a 10th grade education. And you just have to have maybe a few months of extra training, and that's all. So you can understand that their schooling is very, very poor because they don't have very good teachers to start with. Although by the time we left, things were improving a little bit better. Some of the teachers, there was an incentive for them to go on and study more, because they would get better pay. If they had the equivalent of 12th grade, they would get a better pay. And if they had equivalent of going on into college, they would get still a better pay. So that was just starting, though, that they even had the opportunity to do this. For that, there was absolutely no opportunity to
even... But to extend their education, they'd have to go outside the country.
Yeah, but now, since then, they will have... they can go to it's called the Academy. It's the only school of higher learning in all of Namibia for black people. I mean, and there's also white students that
except
go there.
Except for Paulinum Seminary.
Yeah. And so they, but to go there, they can only study to be a teacher or a nurse. Those are the only two professions open to them. Nothing else to this day. If they want to go any and do anything else, they have to move out to another part of the country.
To another country.
But also, the dropout is really tremendous. 75% of the children will drop out of school before they reach standard three, which is fifth grade. And then out of those, 97% will drop out before they reach standard six, which is eighth grade. So that doesn't leave very many left. And 1% maybe will reach, like, will go on to a higher level. And then for them, when they do make it to a higher level, and say they've got let's say there's 100 kids who are in this higher level. They decide how many of them will graduate and actually make matric. If they see that there are too many making matric, they will raise the standard even higher so that maybe if they decide out of 100, 30 can make matric, they will make the standard so only 30 can make matric, even though the others maybe would be capable. But they just change the standard every year just to make sure that they only have as many graduate as they want to graduate.
How do they decide how many they want to graduate?
I don't know. I just think arbitrarily.
I think they would probably look at the labor force and how many they need for doing certain jobs, and then they decide here's the number. And so the top 20 of their grades are going to make matriculation.
I think they're all the government.
The South African government. You see, there's a puppet government in Namibia, which is appointed by the state president of South Africa. It's composed of both black and white people, but most of the citizens of Namibia, the black citizens, figure that any black people that are participating in that government are just simply puppets of South Africa. And some of them do try to do more than that, but it's really difficult for them to do so.
Also, for black people, school is, they have to pay a fee. They have to wear a uniform. And like in our village, people just didn't have any money at all, and they still had to wear this uniform, which would cost 14 rands, which was a lot of money, because for some, maybe with a family of 10, they might get 50 rands for all month, and if they have to pay 14 rands for a uniform, it's impossible. And it was by law required that they had to wear a uniform, that teachers were supposed to send them home if they didn't have a uniform. And so for a lot of kids, they just didn't go to school because they didn't have a uniform, which really, it was really kind of sad. Some of them did have uniforms, and they were really, they wore them until there wasn't anything left, that's for sure. Also, they do have, and the other thing about the educational system there, like because the teachers are so poor and they don't really know any kind of incentive to get kids to learn, so that if you come to school and you don't know your lesson or you don't answer that question right, you get beat with a stick or whatever. And they really beat these kids because they don't know. And I remember talking to some mothers once about that, and what did they think about the fact that their kids were always getting beaten for not knowing the right answer? I mean, if they make an answer and it's wrong, they're going to beat them. So there's no incentive to really try to give an answer. And you have to, when they teach, they have to teach by rote. It's only, you have to give the exact answer. You're not taught to think. They don't want them to think. And I asked mothers what they thought, and they thought, well, that's the way you have to do it. What else? How else are they going to learn? They're not going to do their lesson if they don't get beat.
No wonder you have dropouts.
Yes, sure. Of course. And I said, don't you think there's an alternative? Well, they just never even thought that there could be an alternative. And one of the young men who we still keep in touch with, who was, I think, like in 10th grade, I remember him coming back to the village. He went to Windhoek, where the schools are a little bit better. He was in 10th grade, and I remember him coming back, and he told us, he said, well, by the time you reach this standard, you don't get beaten quite so often. So, I mean, can imagine in the U.S. kids of our 10th grade.
It should be said, though, that they do the same in the white schools.
Yeah. Well, I guess we used to do it here a long time ago, too. So it's, and the white children do not have to pay to go to school. It's compulsory, but it's free, and their schools are very high standard, mostly German, but also public schools are Afrikaans.
Do they wear uniforms?
They also wear uniforms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is that where some of the, some of our World Relief costumes, they have blue and white ones they're supposed to make to send overseas, is that what they wear?
No, they don't wear, not the black children don't wear blue and white. The white kids do, but not. The white uniforms are much nicer than the black uniforms, too. They spend 68 rands per child a year for black, equivalent to spending 614 a year for white. So all the schools were really pretty sad. But we do have some church schools, which are better, and they are integrated. And they don't use the same method. They use an English syllabus. We have two Lutheran high schools, and they're really very good. The only problem is when they graduate from these high schools, the government will not accept their diploma. They cannot, like, go on to higher education in South Africa, for instance, because it's not taught in Afrikaans. If they can go on to higher education in South Africa, they have to go to a Bantu school again, which is taught in Afrikaans, and which isn't very good. And it's, I think they have very few black doctors. I think in by 1976, they had one black doctor. And I know just before we went over in 1983, we met a man from Namibia who was studying to be an architect. And so he was going to be the first black architect in Namibia.
Yeah, he was studying in Washington, D.C., Howard University. Nowhere in Namibia could he study, or even South Africa.
Their incentive for, you know, to go on to study, well, it's just not very, not much there, because there's no opportunity for jobs, even, if they do get a better education. Like, we talked to a young woman who'd studied here in the U.S. and gotten her master's degree in medical technician, and she came back and tried to get a job in the hospital, but they told her she was overqualified, because her job would make her be over white people, and there's no way that a black person could ever have a higher job than a white person. And so she just had a hard time, which she probably would have to land up being in some kind of a, working in a restaurant or whatever. I mean, she wouldn't probably even be able to use her training.
How did the Lutheran high schools develop? I mean, did they have to have permits by the South African government, or how were they recognized? They came into being?
I think that they probably just started from first starting with the grade schools and then moving up, and I'm sure I don't think they really needed to have permission. I have to.
But the churches just simply started them, and I don't think they needed to get special permission. It's just whether they'd get recognition, and their diplomas would not be recognized. That's the problem. So, oh, go ahead. You guys want to educate because. You see, there's no compulsory education for black people. You do whatever you want. So in that sense, there's a certain freedom, do you see? But it happens to turn out well for those black people because those are good schools, and they're taught in English.
But I think that now there's more and more of incentive for people to be educated, even if they can't use their education right now. They're thinking about the future when they're going to be independent, and they're going to need people who are educated and who could run this country. And so lots of them want to go on to higher education. And I think right now there are 1,100 students, Namibian students, studying in the United States. And they really like coming to the United States. I don't know, I guess they think in the United States everything is really great, but maybe they haven't, some of them, the ones that do come, usually that have come are going to school at DeKalb, isn't it?
Where?
At the seminary.
Wartburg?
We did Wartburg, and they get really nice special treatment there, so they don't realize that maybe black people don't always get the best of treatment in the U.S. Another problem with their education is they have a tier system of government that if you are white, you work for the white government and you get really good pay. If you are colored, that's another tier. So you work for the colored bureaucracy. And if you're black, then you work for the black bureaucracy. And then that again is divided into tribes. And so, and then you pay taxes to whatever tribe you happen to belong to or whatever tier. And obviously the black people get paid very, very little, and so they have a very small tax base, and this is what they have to use for their education or whatever else they need. And the white have a very large tax base, and they don't know what to do with their money. They have so much, they just don't know what to do. They're always trying to dream up some new thing they can use and spend their money, but they would never give it for the black in any way. So, and then that says the schools in Windhoek are much better. They're usually church schools, and they are integrated, and they're just, the standard is better for the, even for the lower grades, if you can afford to send your child there. And that's the problem again, most of them can't afford to send their children to those schools. So are there any questions?
Are there any Lutheran hospitals?
Beg your pardon?
Lutheran hospital?
Yes, there is one Lutheran hospital.
Could this medical technician work in a Lutheran hospital?
She probably could have. She was from the southern part of Namibia, and Lutheran, only one Lutheran hospital there is in the northern part of Namibia. And I lost track of her. Now, she might have gone up to the northern part, but actually, people from the south are kind of afraid to go to the north because the north is the war zone, and they're not sure that they really want to live in the war zone. And so I really can't say what happened to her, but she could have gotten a job there. They would have.
The country is split by the South African government, so that when you go to the north, you have to go past military checkpoints. It's like crossing a border. And you're parked there in your car, and there's a soldier in front of your car with a machine gun pointed at your windshield while you show your police pass and so forth. Whereas there's no appreciable border whatsoever between Namibia and South Africa. It's just like the states are here in the U.S. But here there is this border when you go past Tsumen, and she would have to work there. She would have to get special permission too. She might have had trouble with that, you see. We don't know that.
Maybe
her situation.
That's true, that she might not have been able to get. One of the time we had a chance to go up into the north, we went up to the north a couple of times, but this one time we went with the principal, and he took us to visit his sister who lived way, way in the bush, almost on the Angolan border. And you know, you think you wouldn't hardly see a human being up there, but there were the army tanks. And then when we arrived, a little while later, they came to the house and wanted to know, were we safe and what were we doing in this part of the country, and probably would give these people a hard time later on because we were being guests in their house. They had a school way up in this country, and that was, again, a very large school. And the woman there, she was the principal of the school. She taught school, taught English and history. She was training three other teachers, and she had 13, they weren't all hers, but 13 children living in her house that she was responsible for. And her husband was in England getting his master's degree in education, and so then he was going to come back and help her in this situation. But she already had her master's degree. And so there are some schools that, you know, especially in the north, that are a little bit better.
You've shared some about how oppressive the living conditions are for the black people there. I just wondered if you could share a little bit more on how the people react to this oppression.
Well, I think, of course, the way they're reacting now is that they just don't want to accept it anymore, and so they are willing to take up arms, I guess, which for a long, long, long time they were willing, you know, to say, let's try and work it out, and they weren't ready to take up arms. But I think now, in most of the people, I would say, are to the point where they would be willing to take up arms, because they just don't want to live that way anymore. But the other thing I'll say about them, I think they love their country very, very much. And so, you know, they really want to fight for their freedom. And at the same time, we found that they were very, very forgiving people. I mean, they, like, if they do get independence, they don't want for the white man to leave. They want that the white man should stay. And they know, you know, that they can learn a lot from the white man, but they want to live together as equals. And so they would be willing to forgive all that, you know, everything that's gone wrong. And they sure treated us very, very well. And I don't think, I don't know, I never had the feeling that the people in the village thought, had any resentment to the people that were living in the seminary. Because the seminary housing was, you know, was better than the village housing. So we did live on a different standard. But that was also the black lecturers who lived on better standards.
As well as the students themselves.
Yeah. But I never felt that there was resentment there for that.
It should be stated that the all the churches in Namibia, and we'll enlarge on this later on too, have great credibility among the people because the church leaders, the pastors, the bishops, speak up for their people and they speak against the oppressive system. And when one of their people is arrested or detained, they'll go and try and get him out, and they'll make a protest to the military and to the security police and so forth, so that the people have great faith and confidence in their church. And this is a good thing to see, you know. For them, the church is a daily presence in their lives. It's not just so much a place you go to, but it's their whole, their community is their refuge from the oppressors.
For what reason are people arrested and detained, and are there any groups that actually have taken up arms?
Yeah, okay. There we'll have more detail on that now, but I have to answer your question. You've heard of SWAPO, which stands for, it's not an African word, it's an acronym, Southwest Africa People's Organization. That is the major political party in Namibia, which is recognized at the United Nations. However, in 1966, this party, SWAPO, was made outlaw by the South African government. Up until that time, it was a non-violent, passive resistance kind of party. But as soon as they were outlawed, then they formed a military arm. And those are the guerrilla fighters. The guerrilla sanctuaries and camps, many of them are in over the border in Angola. And this is why South African troops often make incursions into the territory of a sovereign state, because they say they got to go after these guerrillas who are endangering the security of Namibia. Did I answer your question? I've forgotten on it.
I was wondering if people were detained and held.
The detaining is mostly done among people in the northern part, because of course many of their relatives, friends, and so forth might be involved in the SWAPO guerrilla movement, and so they'll detain people because they think that you have information about there's some SWAPOs, guerrillas have come in, they're going to bomb someplace or something, and you know where they are, so you must tell us. And they will detain people. Sometimes they will detain people without any accusation at all. The South African government has passed a so-called security resolution, which allows them to detain people without cause and without recourse to a lawyer. They can detain them for 90 days. And after the 90-day period is up, they can renew it for another 90 days, and they can keep on renewing. They just simply say, this person is a threat to the security of the country, and therefore we are detaining him. And they have even no specific accusations.
I'd just like to say in closing, since we're talking about ecology this right now, celebrating Chief Seattle tomorrow, about ecology in Namibia, I think maybe like the sand people or the bushmen are maybe, I would say, best as far as ecology. They really, you know, try to keep the desert the way it is. If they find flour or something that they know they can use to eat, they will only take one and they will leave the other one because their children might need it, or and then so that it can keep producing. So they're very conscious of, I think, ecology and just the way they respect nature. If they they hunt, need to kill an animal to eat, they will have a dance after they kill the animal to thank the animal for dying for them so that they can eat and live. And
so they sort of apologize to the animal in a
way. Don't, you know, they don't want to waste anything. And again, and so, but the rest of Namibia, I'm afraid that the Western influence is there. And I don't know, when we lived in at the seminary, I just couldn't believe what they do with their trash. Because there aren't many people there, I guess, so they just don't think about it. But they can just take their trash and just throw it out on the hillside. So, you know, there's just trash everywhere. And to get them to understand that, you know, dig a hole and bury your garbage. Like for the seminary, I think they would come and pick up the garbage and drive it, as they said, out into the jungle. Well, their idea of a jungle, and I was different. But anyway, out into the desert and just dump it. They wouldn't necessarily dig a hole. They just dump it. And so we were trying to make them a little bit more aware that they really need to think about doing something better with their garbage than that. And also along the highways, I don't know, we really bombarded them with soft drinks, and it's too bad, it's ruining their teeth too. Just along the highways, it's just cans everywhere, you know. I just can't believe all. It's worse than in our country.
Throw them out the window, you know.
Throw
them off the truck.
So all on the highways, you just find these cans, which, no, there aren't any signs to mess up.
Where the cans from?
Pop cans.
Coca-Cola, Sprite, anything anything you know of.
They have to make the worst something when people are too poor, they collect
them. They should.
Could, yeah. That could be a good idea.
But so far they haven't come that far.
Made to help see that they get cleaned up.
I know. It was...
There's one thing I wanted to mention before about, well, I guess it's geography. I think it's a rather important nice thing about Namibia. Namibia here in this area called the Etosha Pan has one of the largest game reserves in the world. And it's a beautiful place to visit. The Etosha Pan is a huge pan which for during the winter months is dry. And then in the summer months becomes a huge shallow lake. Fish come in there and everything. I don't know what they're doing. They're down in the dirt, I guess, beforehand. There's fish there, and all the animals are there. You can go and visit this Etosha Pan. You can see elephant and lion and zebra and giraffe and all kinds of animals in the wild. It's a very, very interesting and beautiful place, and I'm glad that they are reserving that. And another thing I wanted to tell you about. This is kind of, an interesting point. On this border here with Angola, there is the Okavango River. Now, the Okavango River flows inland, and it flows down here, and it ends up in the Okavango swamp. I never heard of a river doing that before. It's a swamp, and this is... This is some of the area where the Bushmen or Sand people live in that general area. I just wanted to mention those.
I think our time is almost up.
Well, we got about 2 or 3 minutes.
And this is one of the books that we suggest. I think it's in.
It'll be there. Yeah,
Kameta. It's called Why, O Lord by Kameta, and he's written psalms and sermons and different things, and it's really. Very good, but I would, in closing, just like to read one of his psalms, and it's the 23rd psalm that he paraphrased. The Lord is my shepherd. I have everything I need. He lets me see a country of justice and peace and directs my steps towards this, his land. He gives me new power. He guides me in the paths of victory as he has promised. Even if a full-scale violent confrontation breaks out, I will not be afraid, Lord, if you are with me. Your shepherd's power and love protect me. You prepare for me my freedom where all my enemies can see it. You welcome me as an honored guest and fill my cup with righteousness and peace. I know that your goodness and love will be with me all my life, and your liberating love will be my home as long as I live. So let's give you some idea of what
Pastor Kameda is the assistant to the bishop of the Southern Church, to Bishop Frederick. He's been in fact at Holden Village, I believe, some time ago, and some of you may have met him then.
Where are the arms coming from for the Namibians that are choosing to arm themselves?
The arms? Many of the arms are coming from the Eastern Bloc of nations. The Swapo people originally asked for help in their freedom movement from the West and were turned down flat. They needed help, and so they turned to the East, East Germany, Russia, I presume. And, you know, some people complain about this, and they say, well, we're not puppets of the communists, but when a person is thirsty, he will take a drink of water from whoever will give it to him. This is the way they describe and explain that. But, yes, that's where arms come from.
Is that happening with any growing rapidity, or from your perspective, how soon is an armed uprising going to be imminent, or to any degree successful, or just totally
squashed? Well, even at this point, they call that the war zone, and this means there are little skirmishes here and there, you know, sort of hit and run kind of thing, as far as the Swapo are concerned. The Swapo guerrillas sometimes come in and they'll place a bomb somewhere, and they always try to. This is really true. They place it in a place where it will not. They try to place it where it will not hurt people, but destroy property or destroy some military installation. Now, when this is going to become full scale, I don't know. But this kind of guerrilla warfare has been going on for 10 years. And I don't know.
Maybe the same time as South Africa. I think that the
upset of the South African apartheid government and the independence of Namibia are going to be probably pretty coincidental. I think they will have to come together. And I don't know how long that's going to be, because, of course, in South Africa, you've got 24 million blacks and 5 million whites, but you've got all kinds of firepower among the whites, and they can hold out for quite a while.
Do you foresee South Africa, I mean, since we're basically talking there as the government, having any real vulnerabilities? I mean, one of the big arguments, other than maybe oil, is that, you know, they've got all the mineral resources, and we need them more than they need us. And, you know, that's always been the big argument against the sanctions is that, you know, we need their minerals more than they need our support, kind of thing. And do you see any, having been in the neighborhood, do you see them having that weak spot that the U.S. government, if it were so, you know, Jesse Jackson gets his vice presidency, I mean, do they have any real options in that area that would be effective?
If we really imposed sanctions, I mean, it's been token so far,
right.
Believe me.
Right.
If we really did, it would very much hamper the South African government. It would hamper the country economically. For a long time, I was wondering myself about whether sanctions was a good idea, because, as everyone said, you know, it hurts the black people more than the white. But the black people are saying, all the black people that we know, all of our friends, are favor it, because they say, well, we suffer anyhow. We might as well suffer for some purpose. See, so that's as much as I know about now. And as far as I think the implication of one of your question, Dave, had to do with how long might this go on. You know, I would like to say I hope to see Namibian independence in my lifetime, because I want to go back there and visit. And I have a hunch I won't be able to get into, we wouldn't be able to get into the country until it's independent. We probably wouldn't be able to get a visa anymore, I don't think.
He depends who you talk to. You know, some will say, okay, in my lifetime it's going to happen, and others will say, no way.
I think now we have to go on with this video, and I don't know who, is there someone here who knows how to operate this? This video is called A Cry for Freedom. It says by Reverend John Evanson, who is with the Namibia News Committee, or whatever it is called, in London, England, I believe. And this will give you a good idea of the problems and the oppression going on in Namibia.